Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene Podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. This week, the return, the long-awaited return of Snooker Player Bingo. Now, if you haven't heard this before, it's very simple. I write down, and in this case, Phil Yates also wrote down a list of players. They've each got a number. We pick a number and we just talk about the players. Although the twist this time is that they're not all players, as you'll find out in listening. It was myself and Phil, Neil Folds as well. And Alan McManus joined us. He had to go and do some filming for ITV because we were at the Champions in Coventry. But he joined us for a few reminiscences as well. So settle back and enjoy the latest segment, the latest instalment of Snooker Player Bingo. Okay, and the first thing to say is I haven't checked back anyone we've done before. So if there's any repetition, I couldn't be bothered to check. So if there's any repetition, then sorry. That's the disclaimer.
What's the worst thing that can happen? Someone gets
killed, maybe. I don't know. That's probably the worst thing that could happen. Anyway, so Neil, you're going to pick one from Phil's list.
Two.
Laurie Annandale.
Ah, referee. And indeed a player in his day. He partnered Stephen Hendry to, you'd know this, Alan, to the Scottish something.
Doubles or something, yeah. I've actually got a story about Laurie. After we won the World Cup in 96, Laurie, being a keen golfer, he organised a club called Thornton Golf Club in Scotland. He organised, it was a centenary year, so they were building a new clubhouse. So he got myself, Stephen and John, this so-called dream team nonsense.
It wasn't nonsense, it wasn't dream.
Well, 21 years ago today, apparently, as we record this now.
Really? Well, I didn't
just
know
saw that online, yeah. Anyway.
I didn't know that, I'm looking at it. But so we went up and played the game of golf and opened the club, and we actually got a lifetime membership to the golf club, which is a pretty cool thing to have for any place, and I still go golfing there today. But Laurie, when I first played amateur snooker, which would have been winter of 87 or something, and December 87, my first tournament I played there, Laurie was the Scottish secretary of the Scottish Billiards and Snooker Association, then he eventually, obviously, professional referee and blah blah blah, you know. But lovely guy, he's still in Scotland, I believe he's back in Rosyth. He loves a good guy.
Yeah. He I think he's the only referee who's ever stopped a fight on the floor of the Crucible, which was between Quinton and Andy Hicks, when they had that bad tempered row which led to the fight with Quinton and with Mark King. And he had to get between them, I mean, he had to literally stop them inflicting harm.
I don't think I've ever seen a referee, and I've seen him referee hundreds of matches. He never made a mistake. I can honestly say I never saw him involved in any kind of controversy. The players have absolute total respect for his abilities to, you know, to officiate a game. But of course, his other hidden talent was putting on tips. Yeah. Stephen Hendry flew him to Belgium specifically. Yeah. He went. He had a day trip in Belgium. He flew from, I think it was Edinburgh to Antwerp, put the tip on and went back home, and Hendry won the tournament.
Another brief story. You're right. And I don't know, as someone who's a bit of a cue doctor, a fettler, is that the word?
Let's go with it.
Let's say a cue fettler. So anyway, but Laurie had a hut out in his back garden with a lathe in it and blah blah blah, and for doing all the cue stuff. And it was him who taught me how to put a tip on properly.
Right.
With just a Stanley blade, not the knife, not the handle, just the blade, little pieces of, you know, wool and sandpaper and all that. And he was brilliant at it. And so then Stephen being
cue fettlers are Laurie Annandale, Fraser Patrick, Les Dodd.
Well, I think a fettler would be someone who actually does put ferrules and not just the tips.
It's not a word though. You made that.
I think it could be.
What's that program? Is it Robert Robinson? Was it a fettler?
You'd be busy getting Robert Robinson to decide if this is right or not.
It's worth looking up in the dictionary, but I don't think
it's in there. Personally.
Well, okay. Well,
it might be now after this.
It could be one of the words of 2018.
Yeah.
The other thing he used to do is double
along with Banks.
His great role was making everybody in the press room laugh because he was a sort of foul, sort of annoyed all the time, old curmudgeon, and he used to play up to it. He used to make us laugh so much. Yeah, it was really good value. Yeah.
Well, what he used to do, because in those days to get the match sheets, you used to have to print them off and hand them round, and he would come round shouting, "Slave to the press, slave to the press," pretending like he did. It was just an effort, even though he was being employed, basically to run the press office. Yeah. He couldn't be bothered to get up and do it.
Well, what about the time when you were working for the WPBSA and you went business and he went economy?
He took that well. He was only assistant tournament director. But anyway, let's move on. So, Alan, pick a number between 1 and 7.
Six.
Well, he's not a player, but in many ways,
he is a player. It's Barry Hearn, who of course is running the game. The thing about Barry, I mean, I think a lot of people think that he started in snooker when he met Steve, but he was running snooker clubs before then. He's actually, you know, was, and very successfully.
At a time when snooker clubs weren't, you know, de rigueur. I mean, back then there were snooker halls. Snooker clubs as such became popular, very popular all the country over, after the 80s explosion in interest. So back then it was quite a sort of niche place, and he made those Lucana clubs very, very successful, didn't he?
The first sporting person he ever took on was my dad, before Steve Davis. Yeah, you know, he won the first Lucania tournament at Romford. My dad represented the Lucania club in Southall, and then they went on a tour. There was a tour that my dad was involved in, and he still says to this day that my dad was the first. Never mind all these boxers, these glamorous boxers and all this, and Steve, but my dad was the first sort of person he worked as an agent for. And that's a long time ago. I've known him so many years, and he's never changed. He's always been this amazingly entrepreneurial, full of energy. Lots of stories with Barry. Yeah, lots of stories. I mean, even from my own point of view, I came out of my time with Barry a year early, but we've never had a one cross word. You know, I get on great with him. He's a great bloke. He's a great bloke. You could speak a long time about Barry.
And very down to earth. You know, he will speak to anyone the same way, won't he? He'll just take the mickey out of everybody, basically, and put you at ease, I guess, doing that.
Well, he's quite obviously a multimillionaire, and he's a very big player in world sport now, especially with the advent of Anthony Joshua. And if he came in here now, he's just so easily approachable and such a nice guy. And I have to say this, we have a laugh and a joke on this, but just for a moment, what he's done for snooker has been phenomenal. I mean, how anybody could possibly complain about what he's done for snooker? He's taken it from the gutter in terms of its financial and sort of economic standing in the world of sport, and now it's going right up there. I mean, tournaments every week for big money. He's performed miracles.
Just big man. Neil said earlier about he's not changed, he's always the same. I had just a quick story about him. I think it was about 92. I went down and had a meeting with him. It was actually at the press conference for the Watson Eubank fight. It was at the Grosvenor House Hotel in London, with Reg Gutteridge and all these people there. Anyway, so he goes down, has a meeting with him. He was going to sign us up to do whatever the snooker guys did with him. And I'm a Glasgow guy, he was London, da da da. And it was a nice conversation, a nice meeting. And then at the end of it, I said, "Look, Barry, thanks. But I says, but no thanks, I'm just going to go my separate ways." And he shook my hand, he says, "Ah, good on you, son," and blah, blah, blah. And listen, you know, no hard thing, and he's always been great with us. I had a nice game of golf with him actually last year at Loch Lomond.
If you took everything away,
he's a top guy.
If you took everything away from Barry right now, his family, his home, all his money, and just threw him in a field somewhere, he would within 6 months be a millionaire again. Everything. He'd find a way of turning everything around. Not that anyone's ever going to do that.
Well, let's hope not. Let's hope not. What I can't understand is how is it that he does not have an honour at all? You know, you look at all the people in sport and in business and everything else that have MBEs, OBEs, even knighthoods, he's got nothing. And what he's done across a range of sports,
totally.
I don't know anyone else in British sport who's done what he's done, actually.
Well, I mean, what he's done for snooker, actually, there are still a few people that you see on social media who think otherwise, but that's, to me, ridiculous. And I agree with all you guys about it. I didn't think he could possibly achieve what he has in snooker, and snooker was struggling badly at the time, and everyone was waiting for the day when he'd come back in, and look at the tour now. It's totally different to what it's ever been.
Well, it's miraculous what he's done. If you were working in a factory, and then all of a sudden a boss came in, and he increased your wages by 50, 60, 70%, you'd think it was the best thing since sliced bread. So I cannot understand the criticism. Okay, there's the odd minutiae of schedule and stuff like that people don't like. But, you know, the core of the game has never been healthier.
Yeah, my last words on him is he really believes in hard work. You know, he works hard, he expects everyone else to work hard. And you look at the people that have been, you know, who are part of Matchroom, actually, they've been there years. I mean, obviously, Sharon Tokley is no longer with Barry, but because she went over to immigrate, I think, to New Zealand. But she was with Barry for years, and I went over to his offices last year, and the people there, when I was still with Barry, were still working there. So he's very loyal to them as well.
And you come to these, we're at Coventry at the moment, at the Champion of Champions, and every time you come to a Matchroom event, whether it's pool or snooker, it's just such a warm atmosphere and so efficiently run. And you just really look forward to it. Every single one we do at the Championship League, don't we?
We do. Yeah.
You know, they look after you so well. And obviously the people who work for Barry are very similar to him, you know, just very approachable and just nice people.
Okay, well, let's... I think you speak up a bit, because I don't think Luke Richards from Matchroom could actually hear that. He's just still over there. Anyway, so have you got your list still, Phil?
Yeah, I have.
Okay, so I'm going to choose one. I'm going to choose number two off your list.
Number two is... One second. Okay. Well, that's Laurie Anderson.
All right, okay, yeah. That went well. We'll have number three then.
Number three, Francois Ellis.
Wow. I've got I've got nothing there.
No, I haven't got much on that, because I think that South African snooker was... When I was around, I mean, I saw him play, I didn't know much about him, but there were a few group of South African snooker players pre-Silvino and Peter Francisco, and you kind of didn't quite know how good they were. He was a fair player, wasn't he? But I remember Jimmy Van Rensburg more, but I don't know too much about him. But there was a few of the guys from London and from England were looking around, and these guys from South Africa, because we know what they're like at all sports. And to be honest, I found them, a lot of them at that point, before the Peter and Silvino came into the game, they weren't quite as good as I expected them to be. You know? But no. I remember, I did see him play.
Yeah, well, I used to write for the South African Argus, so I used to cover all the South Africans, that's why I know him so well. I don't think he ever qualified for a venue, but he came very, very close. It was for the European Open, and he was playing Eddie Charlton, and he went 3-1 up.
Sadly, no footage exists.
No. Apart from in my mind. Yeah, yeah. The psychiatry session stopped 6 months ago. But he was 3-1 up at the mid-session interval, playing all right. And after the interval, Eddie, to say he was in a bad temper is just the understatement of all time. His language wasn't blue; it was purple. I mean, and he was so annoyed. But anyway, he just about got through. But the amazing thing with Ellis was he played in all the qualifiers, because they were in blocks then, by taking his leave, because he was a serving member of the South African military, and he was on like the border of all these hot spots in Africa, and then he'd sort of, okay, well, see you lads, I'll be back in 3 weeks, and, you know, change from his khakis into his waistcoat and come over and play at Blackpool in the qualifiers. It was just an amazing story.
You've dug a name out there from, really, you've gone deep, dug very deep.
You'd even struggle to find him on Q-Tracker. That's how I'm curious.
Yeah. Yeah. No, don't exaggerate.
Oh, no, yeah. Well, that's true. Okay, have you got, that's it for him? Or
that's about it, yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
right. So, Neil, you choose one of mine. 1-7. We've had 6.
I'll have the 7th.
Well, Luca Brasel. Now, we're recording this will go out after the end of the Champions of Champions, so we don't know. At the moment, he's in the semi-finals, but obviously he's won a tournament this year, and I guess he's what the game's been looking for, a new star from a part of the world where we haven't seen many stars.
Yeah, I mean, I've this season I've spent a little bit of time actually with Luca for the first time. You know, I'm probably 20 years older, I spent some time at the pool with him actually in India recently, and he's a really nice laddie. I think he's come out of his shell. I think when he first came on tour, when he struggled with language and maybe one or two other things. His dad actually used to go all the tournaments, but he no longer does, which is good. And he's good mates with Alex Ursenbacher, who started showing signs of being a real good player. So he's kind of got a little buddy on tour, which, you know, being from mainland Europe, it's different, isn't it? For him, you know, it must be hard.
And he's made century breaks left-handed when he was school age. Which is a bit unusual, isn't it, really?
Absolutely.
He's a right-handed player. And I remember quite a lot, the early stage of social media, he used to send messages to people like myself and just talking about the matches. He just loved talking about snooker. But when I met him for the first time, he didn't say a lot. I mean, it's quite strange. You know, very able to communicate via social media. Then he didn't say a lot, very shy. He's come out of his shell. He's tremendous, tremendous for the game. And he's got that swagger about him now, hasn't he? Mm. Now he's won a ranking event. He's got something that makes him an extremely dangerous player. And even in the tournament that we are currently at, as you said, the Champions of Champions, just the way he walks around the table, he is truly enjoying playing on the snooker tour. Not everyone does.
Mm. There are flair players and flamboyant players, entertaining players, but he is all three plus unpredictable. He's a lot like Tony Drago in that respect. You never know quite what he's going to do, and I think he's absolutely phenomenal for the game, especially because of where he's from. As you say, you've got Ursenbacher now from Switzerland, you've got him from Belgium. Suddenly continental Europe has got two, you know, really top class players, and he couldn't have come at a better time. All we need now is a couple of really good players from Germany and we're away.
He certainly studied the game when he was younger, because when he was a teenager, he recorded every match from the World Championship and watched them all. Even the bad ones, he watched back to back, which takes a lot of discipline.
It takes a lot of doing. But I suppose it's one way of learning, you know. I mean, if you really are that into the game, and you want to learn all about the good and the bad of it, and what it's like to be a snooker pro, that's one way of doing it. Not many people would choose to do it. But, you know, you can pick up a lot of information by just watching.
I think part of the reason it's taken him, what, 5, 6, 7 years to come through and be a kind of top-class player he is now is the fact that he's from Belgium, lives in Belgium. I think it's Mechelen or somewhere. He's somewhere around there. He literally doesn't have any other good players to play against. So I think that's probably a big reason why it's taken him 7, 8 years to pick up, because he was a good player, but he didn't have a game. He could just pop balls in it. I remember him playing Steve Maguire at a Crucible debut, and he was a bit all over the place, but you could see that the raw tools were there. So it's good that he's now the finished article, but he's getting there.
He's won the China Championship, that's what everybody's going to say, you know, so far. That's the highlight of his career, and rightly so. But we've seen him absolutely destroy Judd Trump in the Champion of Champions in 51 minutes. But it's not the first time he's done that to an absolutely top-class player. What happened in Northern Ireland with Murphy?
He beat Sean Murphy 4-0, and it's one of those very rare matches where I honestly don't think Sean Murphy had a chance in any of the frames. And that's, you always get a chance at snooker, that's what you're always told, you will get a chance. So he's done it on more than one occasion, so he's a pretty devastating player, and the potential is boundless for him.
And he also passed a test, didn't he, because he lost to Marco at the World Championship, Marco Fu, from 7-1 up. Very public defeat, and you know that would really have hurt, but he's bounced back from it immediately, and he's obviously taken the positives from it, and you know he won something like 9 deciders in a row this season,
he's won 9. That was the last one he lost a decider.
That's impressive. We shall continue. Have you got to leave us, Alan, or you're hanging
no,
on
I'll be
home. You're hanging on. Fine, okay, so. I don't know who's listening. We'll go back to yours, Phil.
Okay.
Well, you pick one, Alan, from Phil's list.
Number 1, please.
Paul Gibson.
My god. You thought Francois Ellis was obscure.
Well, I know what happened to him. I played him first match of one of the seasons, about the 86 season. But then he had this thing where he got an injury on a roller coaster, didn't he? Which kind of ended his career just about.
Neck injury.
It was a good play. I don't know how good he was, thinking about it. Got a neck injury on it, but was that one of the events, wasn't it, that happened?
Yeah, I think it was. The reason I mentioned him was because, well, he's from Nottingham as well, originally. And, of course, the other player with a neck injury from Nottingham is Anthony Hamilton, who's playing in this tournament. So there is a bit of a link there. But how unlucky was that? Yeah, he was a perfectly healthy individual, reasonable player, you know. I think he went to be a policeman afterwards, actually. But anyway, all of a sudden, his life like that was completely changed by some sort of random event that he had no control over whatsoever.
When did it happen?
It was either in Blackpool or Morecambe. It was either one or the other. Yeah.
Which ride do we know?
I don't know. I won't be going on it.
No, I don't think anyone should, by the sounds of it. Okay. Phil, you choose 1 to 5.
I'll go 2.
Well, you would have written about this man a lot when you were writing for the Grimsby Telegraph. Dean Reynolds.
Dean Reynolds, well, whitewashed in a final by Steve Davis. A real hard nut to play. And this is no criticism of Dean whatsoever, but I have to say he was involved in the worst final I've ever seen. That 89 British Open final against Tony Meo. It was a really, really, really poor match. But, I mean, he had a very, very good career. Really good.
And he played him again, didn't he, at the Crucible, shortly after, and was warned for slow play. But Tony wasn't.
That was, I thought at the time, I mean, I thought that was really unfair. It's debatable whether Dean should have been warned for slow play or not. But what wasn't debatable is that if you're going to warn one, you've got to warn them both because they were equally slow. So that was a bit unfair.
He cried, didn't he, after that?
He did, absolutely, yeah. The other one, of course, the other great moment he was involved in, which I'll never forget, I think it was in a UK championship in an early round, and he was playing Tony Chappell from Wales. And he got into trouble because he was as Chappell was at the table reading a newspaper.
He was. It was a Sunday morning. He's reading the Sunday paper, and he obviously thought Tony Chappell was slow. So there's kind of irony in all that, really, that he ended up getting done for it. But he did. Yeah, he was reading the paper. I first bumped into him when Junior Pot Black, the first year I was in it, and there were some good players in that, and he won it. It was Dean O'Kane came over, John Parrott. guy called Tony Pyle, who was down from Exeter, some real good players, but he won it. And he, to be honest, he was the best player on the show, better than John and certainly better than myself and Dino at the time. And I always thought he was a good player as a professional, you know. I didn't always get on great with him, I have to say, but, you know, he was a very, very good and very underrated player.
And he was a lot like you, Alan, in the sense that when it came to angles and the tactical side of the game, he was really shrewd, and that's why he was so hard to beat. Well, to get into the top 16 in that area, you've got to be a very, very good player.
Yeah, I kind of missed him as a top player. He was kind of going down as I turned pro, but I remember playing him once. I think it was actually in Thailand, because I remember being on a flight and he told me he was going to beat me. that's actually true. And he had a couple of sherbets, you know, so he was... that was that, and I was only a kid. I was only 20 or something, 21.
But did he beat you?
I don't think he did, actually.
I don't think he did.
You know he did.
No, I don't think he did, because I think he had a couple of drinks before the night before the match as well. Yeah. So, I tell you one thing he did have that he was playing for me. It's a talent.
Yeah, lots of talent.
He maybe didn't use it in the best way. I don't really know, yes. But he certainly, again, a bit like Luca, you know, in the modern day, but he, the tools that he could have been a real, real good player.
And when you live in Britain, you know Grimsby, it's a big fishing port, or at least it was, and you know about the town. But I think people the world over don't appreciate it. It's quite a small place, and yet what a hotbed of snooker it was. In 1975, they produced the British junior champion, Mike Hallett, the English amateur champion, Sid Hood, and the world amateur champion, Ray Edmonds. Now, for three different players to win those titles, to go from one small place, extraordinary. And then, of course, Dean came through, who was a fine player, and plenty of others as well.
Stuart Carrington, this year, made three centuries in a row at the World Championship, which is pretty impressive.
Funny you mention Stuart Carrington. Mm. Last time I seen Dean Reynolds was at the English Institute of Sport up in Sheffield, and I was playing Stuart Carrington, and Dean came with him to watch the game. And that was the last time I seen him anyway. It was 6-7 years ago. But it was a good player.
And from a newspaper point of view, he was absolutely excellent, because he gave great quotes, and you know, it was always a story there. So I have to thank him for that, because he was tremendous with me when I was doing the local paper.
Let's go back to your list, Phil.
Okay.
What have we got left? Numbers?
Right, we've got.
What can possibly follow Francois Ehlis and Paul Gibson?
The two players are left. Neither of them are obscure. Number four or number five?
We'll have number four.
Eddie Charlton.
We'll Eddie Charlton. Okay.
Well, my story about Eddie Charlton, and I may have even said this before, but I was told a story by, I think it was Dennis Taylor, that every car journey he ever went on, he checked his oil and his tyre pressure and his water on every journey. But I'm not just talking about, if he'd going to travel 300 miles. If he went over to the newsagents and got a paper, he would have to check the oil and water and everything again before he'd drive it back to his house. Which kind of shows you that he's...
fastidious, I think the word is.
Yeah, that's the
meticulous,
word.
Maybe another
meticulous,
word.
to the point of, he's making all these safety checks. That was the kind of guy he was. Mm. You know, he was
even in his life, safety play was important.
Absolutely.
It's really, really interesting you say that, because I've seen him in action. He was known, or somebody told me, he was the most fastidious packer of a case you've ever seen in your life. And on one occasion, he came into the press room and he was sort of putting some stuff away in his case because he was going off somewhere else. And so I sort of made a point of sort of walking over there. And this case was just pristine. I mean, everything was just perfectly in place. So obviously, a bit of an obsessive mind, maybe. Yeah.
I played him at the Crucible when it was hard, because he wasn't as good a player as he once was. And I was on the way up, but I had a horribly hard game with him. And he used to be moaning and groaning, swearing under his breath, calling me all the names. It was like Merv Hughes at cricket, and he's sledging you. Ultimately, he wasn't quite good enough in the end. He couldn't. But, you know, at that point in his life, but it was a horrible match. I couldn't wait to get over with. I didn't know when there was no breaks. Everything went, all the balls went awkward in every frame. And he moaned and groaned throughout the whole match. But I actually had a lot of respect for him, you know. That was kind of all on the table, off the table. He was a good guy.
Yeah,
good guy.
Couple of things. I actually remember sitting in the balcony in the Crucible on the right-hand table. Is that table one, going down the steps and to the right?
Yeah.
I think it is, anyway. He played JP there, and JP beat him 10-0. I remember actually sitting in the balcony watching it. Another brief World Championship story about Eddie, a good pal of mine, Paul McPhillips. didn't ever get to the Crucible, but he lost. It was two matches from the Crucible. He played Les Dodd. Les Dodd beat him 10-9 in the black to play Eddie Charlton to get to the Crucible, and Eddie didn't turn up. So one of my best mates has effectively lost 10-9 in the black to get to the Crucible, and he never ever got there. But that's true. Eddie was the 17-32 seed at the Qualies, yes, and he never turned up for whatever reason. I'm not that sure.
It's one more thing there. Is that the obviously Pot Black as a kid? It was always on. Do you know? I don't even know which day. I think it was a Thursday night. But anyway, it was 9 o'clock, and you weren't meant to know who won it. A bit like the Bake Off, you know. But someone used to leak.
They didn't tweet it in those days.
They used to tweet it, no. But you could, you know, the word got out who won it. But the word got out this year in particular that there'd been 100 break made, and it was Eddie. And I still remember the break, 110, and you knew it was coming. And then isn't it strange? I absolutely could not go out that night.
Yeah.
I wanted to watch that break of 110 of any chance, because the centuries on the television were.
Mm. That's a cool thing.
Yeah, you know, really sort of hard to. You never saw them, basically. Yeah. And you can still see that break. I've seen it on YouTube, and brilliant. You know, to think that he could do such a thing was, going back shows you what a good player he was. You know, he's played in one frame tournament, he's made a century. I mean, you know,
he made the first one at the Crucible, I think. First century.
He did.
And he also came really close to being world champion. Almost beat Ray Reardon. Yeah. So, you know, he, for his time, he was a very good player, but Neil's right about his language. I mean,
he's absolutely, unrepeatable.
With today's rules about swearing at the table, had they been in place then,
they'd have thrown the book at him.
He'd have wiped off the national debt of Australia with a fines.
I should say, Alan has left. It's a bit like on the Clive Anderson show when the Bee Gees stormed out. It's a little bit like that. He's just gone without a word.
Morris McManus.
I think it was all those Francois Ellis anecdotes that did him in. Anyway, so I've got a couple left. So I've got 1, 3, 4, and 5.
One,
again, not a player, but someone that everyone of a certain age will remember very, very well, Ted Lowe.
Is anyone on your list actually a player or not?
Dean Reynolds was, I think. Luca Brasell. Ted Lowe, for those who don't know, was the main BBC commentator for basically forever until he retired. He started in the black and white days. He used to sit in the audience and whisper. That's why they called him Whispering Ted. And in the 80s, he was probably as well known, his voice certainly was as well known as a lot of the players.
I remember going to one of the early events in China, one of Barry's events, and Ted was invited along with his wife, whose name I'd forgotten, actually.
Jean, was it?
Yeah, Jean, that's right. And we were at this big function, and it was really, you know, they looked after us beautifully, but there was no sign of any drink there. And Ted enjoyed a glass of wine, you know, it's safe to say, as we all do. But so he was there, Ted, and I haven't seen him look so miserable. And he's sitting on the same table as me, and I said, you're right, to think as well, there's no wine, there's no drink here, I've asked, there's a problem with that. So anyway, we managed to get the person in charge, and someone had a word in his ear, and he'd had a word with the staff there, and a bottle of white wine came from somewhere, and of course immediately he's delighted. So they put a glass next to Ted and Jean, poured quite a small measure into the glass. And then the guys tried to take the bottle away and put it back in the cupboard. And at which point, this thing where Ted has grabbed hold of the bottle and there's like a tug of war thing, like the enormous turnip where the waiter's trying to take the bottle back and Ted is not letting go of that bottle for any money in the world. And Ted won, he snatched it back, put it on the table like that, and he had a vice-like grip on it. And needless to say, there was nothing left at the end. But, you know.
Quite rightly so.
But it was like, say, you can have a small amount of wine, but that was not going to. And he was really. Became much happier.
Ted and I are both TV commentators, but I think that's where that's where the common bond is.
You don't drink.
It's sort of broken. Yeah, I don't drink. Exactly, that's it. But I think I did have one thing in common with Ted, is that he revered, absolutely revered, the best player of his era, Joe Davis. He was fulsome in his praise of Davis any time he had a conversation with him. Now, obviously, now Stephen Hendry's retired, I can quite rightly say, you know, Stephen Hendry was my favourite player. I mean, I just thought he was phenomenal, and I always will do. But when you spoke to Ted, he was absolutely convinced he wouldn't have it any other way that Joe Davis was the greatest player who ever played the game.
He's entitled to that opinion. Yeah. Of course, he was a great player. When I first played, I played in Pop Junior Pop Black, and Ted would have been commentating on that, I think, but I played at the Hexagon. It was one of my first TV appearances, and he was commentating on the match, and he made a point of coming up before the game, writing down a lot of stuff, because obviously your notes were not available then. And it was quite difficult to find that information. He wanted to know about me, my family, my friends who I'm with, and all this sort of stuff. So he was quite thorough in that. I mean, he didn't know the game particularly well, but he's remembered for the voice and you know, the era, wasn't he? And but he was quite meticulous in getting information that maybe members of the general public would be keen to find out that it was not always snooker related.
And there was an incident involving Ted at the Masters many, many years ago.
When he passed out?
Which might be a lesson for me and for everybody in the modern commentary gig, is that he was taken ill on a Saturday afternoon at the Masters semi-final, and thankfully the frame in which he was taken ill was quite a lengthy one, because it took a while for him to be taken out of the commentary box by the medical personnel.
Rex had to prop him up.
Rex Williams was his co-commentator, and they didn't speak for 13 minutes, neither of them, and there was not one single complaint. Now, what does that tell you?
Well, it tells you that you only get told off for speaking too much, not too little.
Yeah. I think I went one frame where I didn't speak for 13 seconds.
After he retired, I wrote a piece for Snooker Scene just about him. I think he'd done an interview and we just sort of wrote about that. And he sent me a handwritten note of thanks, you know, which is very classy. Yeah. I mean, these days you'd be lucky to get a tweet off somebody, wouldn't you? But that was a very sort of old school way of, you know, doing things, I think.
He was a real gentleman, and when he had people come up and ask for autographs at the Crucible, he could not have been more accommodating to them and very gracious.
Yeah. Okay, we'll do two more. We'll do one, your last one, and one more from mine. So who's your last one, Phil?
My last one is, we're in Coventry, as you know, and he's a West Midlander and a man I liked a lot, actually.
Dominic Dale? Because that's where he's from.
Yeah.
No, not him.
Sorry to interrupt. You sound like Mark Williams on Twitter. This person's name is Graham Miles, who was a former world championship runner-up and a winner of Pod Black.
Yeah, my first ever professional match was against him, and it was one of those events. It was in Stockton-on-Tees, and I can't remember the name of the event. It was a big pro tournament, and I played Graham Miles there. And he beat me. He was, you know, a really good player, Graham Miles. And he took me out afterwards to a casino. I had a great time. Then he was about 19. I found him a really good bloke, actually. And of course, he knew everyone at the time. He was kind of high up in the game. But he was my first ever opponent. And, you know, for anyone who thinks that guys like that were not really good players, and you believe just nowadays that everything's much better than it was then, he was a tremendously good player and sort of classy sort of guy as well.
And he could do something of a quality level at snooker that the generation now probably couldn't do. He made the vast majority of his income even then by playing exhibitions, and I've seen him on numerous occasions build a century break and sort of a third of the way through stop, tell a joke, which was very funny, get to about 60 odd, stop, tell another joke, and then go on to make a three figure contribution. Really brilliant at exhibitions. The other thing, of course, technically, he was one of his own, wasn't he? Because he was so left-eyed sighting. Yeah. It was extraordinary.
One thing sticks in my mind, it's probably not that interesting a story, but I played him once, and it was a crucial stage of the match. I was about to win, and I was 63 in front with 5 reds left. And he took one look at the score before he came to the table, and then he never looked back up at the score, and he knew which colours he could take. He could take a blue and a pink, and he never took one sort of gaze at the scores, as people do. We all do things now. You need to double check this. And he cleared up and won the frame by 1 point. But I thought it was clever that he didn't bother all that. People do it, don't they? They just can't help themselves but double and treble check to make sure they've made a mathematical error. But he was a great player.
Clive Everton, who knew Graham really well, also that one of his faults was that he always thought he was 90 minutes from everywhere, when in fact he wasn't. And I think he does hold the record for turning up late for most matches. I think he played a match against Jim Medicroft where they both turned up late, so it was 1-1 and neither of the ball hadn't been potted.
Well, I think I've told this story before, but I had to ring him up to do one of his Where Are They Now pieces at Sandwell Snooker Centre, which he ran, and I rang and he answered the phone, but he denied being Graham Miles. He just said, "Oh, I'm not Graham Miles." It was Graham Miles. I could recognise him. He said, "Don't worry, I'll give you his mobile number." So I wrote this number down, and it was basically just a random number that he just basically thought of, because when I rang it was just some woman in another part of the country. he just decided to have a bit of a wind up, I suppose, but I got him in the end, but it was a little bit odd.
I think he got involved in, didn't he have a dispute with Alex in an altercation which kind of blows at an exhibition once?
Unusually he had an altercation with Alex, yeah.
But I think he actually punched him.
No, I think he did, yeah.
I think Alex interjected a swear word in a sentence that described Graham as being follically challenged.
Right.
Okay.
I think we know they've got the picture.
Yeah.
We painted a good picture.
Punched
him. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I've got three. We'll do one more. I've got three, four, or five.
Four.
Okay, well, this is another Midlander who no longer plays, but we see him at most events, Martin Clark, who now, he was a former top 16 player, now is one of the tournament directors. Very hard-working one as well.
Great bloke. Great bloke. And I had a misfortune to play him, I think, four tournaments in a row one year. And he beat me in every one. And at that time, I couldn't bear him, you know. I didn't know him at all. I knew he was a nice guy. He beat me in almost every tournament. He was very cool. And I used to call him Lester for some reason at that point.
Yeah, I think it was because of his diminutive size. Lester Piggott.
Yeah, Lester Piggott, yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah. A really good player, actually. I only managed to beat him once, and he beat me a lot of times. And as I say, he was sort of one of these quiet sort of assassins, really. Very, very good player. And his career ended a little bit early.
Neck trouble again, same thing. Not a roller coaster, but probably from playing, I guess.
It ended with him still a very, very good player because he spent a number of seasons in the top 16. But he was uncomplaining, and now he's one of the best backstage people in snooker. He's a tournament director and does a wonderful job. There's only one thing I can complain about Martin Clark. He's a Wolves fan. Apart from that, everything else is good.
I've never heard him or seen him get annoyed with anybody or lose his temper. He may have done, but I've never seen it.
Yeah,
he's one of these guys. He's very, very even-tempered. Who knows what he's like, you know, in his private life, but he seems to be really... You couldn't really imagine having a crossword.
No, yeah, yeah, yeah. No,
and he made the most extraordinary television debut I think anybody's ever made. It was at the Trentham Gardens at Stoke, which is very close to where he lives in Sedgley in the West Midlands. Up and coming pro, and he played Dennis Taylor. Now, Dennis wasn't too far removed then from being world champion, and he beat Dennis 5-0. It was a massive story. It was on ITV, I remember. Massive story.
He had the old poodle haircut, didn't he, at the time?
That's right. From, yeah, it was
the 80s, though. So
yeah,
he does hit balls now because if you get to a tournament early enough when the table fitters are there, he gets his cue out. I think, well, Martin's going to have a game, and he just basically does the testing of the table. So he does hit a few balls now, only that.
But it's good that someone doing that job has been a player. I think he understands what players are going through and what their needs are. Because I think he was like player liaison first, and then he sort of stepped up to John Mike Ganley in the tournament office.
Someone like him and Gary Wilkinson is involved with World Snooker, I think it's brilliant because their life has been snooker, and you know, it's good that they can put something back in and they're able to get something out of it because they understand the players, those guys.
He's got another talent as well, apart from potting balls and from running tournaments now very efficiently. I've never known anybody who can eat hot curries.
Oh, no,
he's
Vindaloo's, all sorts, yeah.
Every credit for
an exhibition almost, isn't it?
Yeah,
I've not seen it, but I've heard all about it. And
he's still making total clearances, just in a different context.
Yeah.
And on that terrible gag, thank you, Neil, thank you, Phil and Alan, who's not here, but
stormed
thank you
off.
To him. Stormed off, had enough. And I'm going to press stop, and then we'll say all the things we really think about those people.